Okay, well then, Randy, what do you think we should talk about today?
Well, today we're going to talk about an idea that most people probably have never heard of. It's called stochastic electrodynamics. And it's one of my favorite ideas in physics, and I've actually got a really interesting and bizarre story to tell you about how I first heard about it. Do you want to hear it?
Go ahead.
I'm not sure if I ever told you the story. I was hired to be the art director for the biggest parade in New Orleans, Mardi Gras, back in 2004 by a parade called the Crew of Endymion. And the parade company that was decorating that parade, I was going to design and art direct it, they were owned by Blaine Kern. He is still alive, but he's not running the company anymore. So I was in the office with Blaine, and we were getting reacquainted. I'd worked with him in the past, but never at that level. And we were talking about, you know, just things that interest us, getting to know one another again. And I must have mentioned something about my interest in theoretical physics and advanced military research and things like that. And he said that his friend had been there just a few days earlier. His name was Gordon Novell, and that he had been getting into these experimental research programs, and he had left Blaine a photocopy of what looked, he showed it to me, it looked like some kind of research paper. It had some photographs, and I only had a brief time to skim over it, but it looked really fascinating, and I picked out that term stochastic electrodynamics off the paper. The interesting thing about this paper was that I've never been able to find a copy of it online since. And I got the impression from Blaine, who told me that I wasn't allowed to make a copy of it to take with me, and that Gordon was very protective of it because he wasn't supposed to be showing people. This paper had photographs of these devices that looked like large metallic eggs. And there was a lot of hardware inside. There was some pictures of the scientists standing next to this thing with the lid open. And there was all of this complex circuitry and looks like piping and so forth inside there. And the paper claimed that by pursuing stochastic electrodynamic principles, they had succeeded in creating these two devices, which they had humorously nicknamed Fat Boy and Little Man, that could levitate in the air. So, of course, this fascinated me, and I started doing some research online about it, and talking about it now is probably going to get me on some kind of government watch list, but so I did some reading up about stochastic electrodynamics and found that it was a very sort of, I don't want to call it fringe because it's based on a lot of excellent scientific work, but it's only being worked on and has really only been advanced since the 60s by a handful of researchers. So that's what got this started, and we're going to talk about this concept today. Stochastic electrodynamics is founded on the idea that the vacuum fluctuations in quantum mechanics, they're actually a real field of electromagnetic energy, that it's not noise and an inherent noise to the particles and the uncertainty about position and momentum and everything, but there's actually an energy field of electromagnetic radiation knocking around particles at the quantum level. It's really a beautiful and classical interpretation of quantum mechanics. So let's start talking about that.
So now the paper that you sent me was called The Contribution from Stochastic Electrodynamics to the Understanding of Quantum Mechanics by De La Peña and Seto. I think this was never published. It was only on the archive. These two guys have been working on this since the 1970s. And I mean, they just recently published a paper in 2016 in the Journal of Mathematical Physics that supposedly derives the Schrodinger equation from something like this. I'm not sure how much this has changed. What you sent me is a 13-year-old paper or 11-year-old paper or something like that. So they could have done quite a bit, but it looks like they're doing the same sort of thing that they were doing, only they've made a lot of progress since then.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the broad view before we get into the specifics. Even on the Wikipedia page, you'll see that there's a number of successful arguments that can be made with this interpretation that predicts well-known physical phenomena like the Casimir effect and diamagnetism and the Unruh effect and the Lamb shift and some other things, right?
So it looks to me, for the most part, that this idea has some traction at least. It takes this fairly basic idea, right, which is random fluctuations of the electromagnetic field will produce stochastic motion and random forces on a moving particle. And when it does that, it's able to make lots of predictions for quantum mechanics and lots of explanations for quantum mechanics. And it does a reasonably good job for some, apparently. That Wikipedia page, when I looked at the Wikipedia page, it said that there were a bunch of people that were arguing with the derivations people made in other situations. I don't know how critical those are. I'd have to look at each one in turn. I think there were five things, like the ground state of the hydrogen atom and stuff like that people didn't like the derivation for, but I don't know why they didn't like it or how critical the arguments are against the derivations people have made for those.
It's a big idea, and it's very difficult to do these derivations because you're dealing with these stochastic principles, and mathematically I think it's really rigorous. And I should probably mention that I've seen this idea, stochastic electrodynamics, connected with the de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory, in that apparently there is a connection where people say that the pilot wave is a phenomenon that's native to the zero-point field that they talk about in stochastic electrodynamics. So,
and that's actually in your Wikipedia article again.
Okay.
And you can see that. You can see that. I mean, that is the problem with de Broglie-Bohm. What is the particle bouncing around in?
Right.
This sort of zero-point field, this sort of fluctuating electromagnetic field with a little bit of energy sitting around in it, is exactly the sort of thing that you could think of as doing that job.
Right. Especially in that, like in the episode that we covered with pilot wave hydrodynamics, where you actually see that the oil bath that the particle is bouncing on has that inherent subvisual oscillation field, right?
Yes. So there's something going on in there that's very, very similar. Now, exactly how similar that is, I'm not completely sure. Even after reading this, I'm not sure how similar that is. But you can get this sort of idea that this is one of the possibilities for that kind of field that's going to knock little tiny particles around at some rate. And so I think when they say that this is a class of de Broglie-Bohm hypotheses, I think that's probably true. Maybe a subclass of de Broglie-Bohm hypotheses.
Yeah, and that connection really fascinates me because I really love the pilot wave theory. And to have this theory being developed sort of in parallel, but with different researchers, just it paints a really beautiful classical viewpoint on the entire quantum world.
It is very nice to have something like this available. Whether or not it ends up being true or not, having interpretations or having, in this case, it's a full-fledged theory, having a theory that can actually explain things is nice. Other than like the Copenhagen interpretation or the many worlds interpretation, which in both of those cases, they just punt any interpretation out the window and say, you've got this wave function, you've got a wave function for the beginning, you have a wave function for the end, you put them together and you get your probabilities. Well, I mean, that's all nice and dandy, but that's not...
It's not a phenomenological explanation.
It doesn't tell you anything about what's going on. It just says you have probabilities. It's very hard to believe that that is all you can really, really say. Well, it may be all you can really, really say. Just like there are other things where you might never know the answer, right? Like what came before the Big Bang, right? Something like that. Assuming there was a Big Bang, what was before? Does it even make any sense to say something like that?
Except in this case, there may be very serious consequences for who's right in this argument. Because if these vacuum fluctuations are in fact caused by real electromagnetic energy, then it's going to have momentum. It is going to be, you know, a pointing vector. There may be ways to get energy out of it. So I think that this is the model, I think, which is at the heart of a lot of really fringe claims. But here we see that it may have a valid physical basis, and we're still trying to figure out if it can be extended to accommodate all of quantum theory's predictions.
People are working on those extensions. I think it looks reasonably good as far as, you know, this paper was concerned and the things that were nearby. That's all I can really say without getting into more detail.
Yeah, fair enough. I don't know if they went into this much in the paper, but did they get into the ground state of the hydrogen atom much?
I don't think they talked about the ground state. I mean, they talked about atomic stability. Why is there atomic stability? But they didn't talk about the ground state of the hydrogen atom itself. Just things like, why are there energy levels? And I think we'd have to talk a little bit about what's actually going on before we start trying to talk about those specific things. But the specific things that I have written down that they talked about were explanations for atomic stability, energy eigenvalues, the origin of quantization, whether or not they're actually trajectories or not, single particle interpretation of quantum mechanics versus an ensemble interpretation, the role of the observer and wave packet collapse, things like that, quantum fluctuations, and the wave behavior of matter. So those are all things we should get to by the end of the podcast, but I think we really ought to talk a little bit more about what's actually going on with stochastic electrodynamics before we talk about those particular things.
Okay, good. We'll circle back to this, but one of the things that I wanted to mention also was that when I was first interested in this theory, there was a paper by Trevor Marshall, who is one of the most vocal proponents and apparently one of the most ambitious and successful proponents of this theory, is that he had made a prediction in 2002 in a paper called Non-Locality, the Party May Be Over. He's kind of a bombastic writer, but he made a prediction in that theory for a phenomenon that was a corollary to an effect that happens in quantum optics called spontaneous parametric down conversion. And he predicted that there would be a corollary phenomenon called spontaneous parametric up conversion in a nonlinear crystal. And it sounds very technical, but briefly put, he made a prediction from stochastic electrodynamics that nobody had ever seen before. And I think it was 2007 or so, somebody actually tried it and failed to detect the effect. And so at that point, I threw up my hands and I was like, oh, damn, that looked so promising. But, you know, the experimental evidence hasn't proven it out. Well, like 2 years later, two different teams of scientists conducted the experiment again and did it better, and they actually detected this effect. Now, I can't be sure if this is an effect which is exclusive to stochastic electrodynamics, but the fact that it made a successful prediction that nobody in quantum theory had ever made before really caught my attention. And so it's been rattling around in the back of my mind ever since.
That is probably the strongest thing in favor of this, is that it did make that prediction that other people hadn't made. There were two observations, I think.
In 2009, 2010, I think one team might have been in Japan.
Yeah, I don't know anything about what's happened since then, what people have been able to do with that, but that is at least an interesting thing to talk about before we go on, is that this is actually something that has done what science is supposed to do, which is make predictions about phenomena. That's what a theory should do, is you look at it, makes a prediction. Ideally, if it can make a prediction that the other theory doesn't, that should give it some weight. It's pretty reasonable.
And it's really exciting. Trevor Marshall seems to think that there is no quantum way to predict this effect, which I find dubious, but he seems to know the field really well. It's his specialty is the optical, nonlinear optics and things like that. So it's really exciting to see that happen. I can't remember the last time there was a challenge to quantum theory like that that bore out a positive experimental result.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think in general, what people have done is they've looked for things in quantum theory that don't make any sense, and then tried to show that they don't happen, and then they do happen.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, lots and lots of things, like the aspect experiment, for example, all that stuff with Bell's theorem and so forth. That was all stuff to show that there's something wrong with how you're interpreting quantum mechanics, because this can't be right. And then it turns out to be right.
That's something that came up in his paper, Non-Locality, the Party May Be Over. And I couldn't follow his argument, but he seems to be convinced that that if spontaneous parametric upconversion was indeed experimentally detected as he had expected, that it would explain the aspect experiments in a totally classical way. Now, I couldn't follow his logic. I'm not sure that he even really got into it in the paper. But that's also really exciting, because if there's a classical explanation for entanglement, then you're just going to have me on board no matter what. Because quantum mechanics doesn't really make a phenomenological explanation for entanglement. So if somebody can offer that, I'm on board.
Yeah, well, I don't understand how.
Yeah, me either.
But the very fact that the de Broglie-Bohm hypothesis is still a valid interpretation, right? It's still an interpretation that you can't disprove, means that at some place, at some point, even there, even in the more general category of possibilities up there, this kind of theory can give you something like entanglement. So somewhere out there, there's probably a reasonably complicated proof about why that is, but I haven't seen it.
I'm going to have to dig for that. So let's talk about the nature of the field itself. That seems like a good place to start, right?
We could either talk about the nature of the field or the principles of linear stochastic electrodynamics. Why don't you talk about the field? We'll get back to the principles later on. I guess the principles need that field to exist.
Okay, well, the basic idea, and this is where I'm a little confused phenomenologically about how this works, but the idea is that there's a field of electromagnetic energy that spans an infinite range of frequencies, which is physically real, and it's Lorentz invariant. So no matter what your state of motion, as long as it's constant, you would be perceiving the same background field. Now, I'm not entirely sure how that works, but one of the things that kind of intrigues me is this thought that if the universe really is infinite and expanding and as it is at higher and higher velocities at greater distances, then no matter what direction or what velocity you move in any direction, you're going to have sort of a bubble of observation that travels with you. So, for example, if you move up in the positive x direction, then the light that from the cosmic background that you're approaching, if there's light coming from objects further and further and further away, then they're going to be more redshifted in that direction. And as you move in that direction, they're going to be blue shifted. But on the other hand, you're going to be moving away from a radiant field in the coming from the other direction, so that's going to be redshifted. But if there's a sort of a uniform, if there's a uniform expanding universe around you in all directions, it should balance out so that you still perceive the same distances and the same spherical universe all around you. See what I mean?
Okay.
So maybe there's some kind of physical explanation for how this field could be Lorentz invariant. Because if there isn't a physical reason, like a causal reason for it, then we have to postulate that it's some kind of inherent property of the universe itself.
Yeah, I think probably if this is happening, then you have to have something like Lorentz invariance. I think that just the existence of the zero-point fluctuations would require that they be Lorentz invariant. Otherwise, you'd have some sort of weirdness going on. It probably just means that the densities, when you do the transformation, the energy densities are constant. And if the energy densities are constant, then that's not too much of an issue. It just means that there's some sort of form for this with whatever way this thing transforms, that when you transform and you shift the frequencies, you shift the size of the energy element when you do your integration in just the right amount so that you don't get any change in what the spectrum looks like. I think that's probably just a feature of the electromagnetic field in general.
Okay. Well, is it good? Then it's not really a big theoretical hurdle.
It sounds to me like if this is electromagnetic in nature, that's probably going to have to happen as well, just because the electromagnetic field is definitionally Lorentz invariant.
So for whatever reason, that is a postulate of the theory, because if it's not a Lorentz invariant field, then none of the calculations work.
So I hadn't known about that, but that's actually one of my notes. You know, what's going on with this relativistically? I think that's because at the very end of the paper, these guys, De La Peña and Seto, keep saying non-relativistic quantum electrodynamics rather than just quantum electrodynamics, which makes me wonder what exactly they're worried about with the relativistic part.
It's just really hard to do calculations in that regime with this theory. So they've looked at the non-relativistic scenarios because they're much, much easier to calculate. But there is work being done in the relativistic area.
It's just sort of weird to read that. I mean, it makes you think immediately what can be done putting this in with general relativity. And of course, always when you think about that, well, if there's an issue with the metric, then whatever I do with special relativity, can I extend it to general relativity?
Right. I suppose one of the things that I found encouraging here is that it wouldn't be that hard to tie in with something like Carver-Mead's G4V gravity theory, because it's speaking the same language of vector potentials and that kind of thing. So really, the physics is totally classical in this theory, but when you add that stochastic noise in the electromagnetic field spectrum, then, you know, I think that's where it gets really hairy trying to run the calculations. Even in the non-relativistic scenarios, they did some simulations that took four different 1.8 gigahertz computers running for 55 days to see if this theory would replicate the various energy levels for the hydrogen atom. And they found really excellent looking match. And that's what's intriguing about this is, you know, we're taught that classically, if you have a charge going in a circle, that it's going to radiate. And so therefore the classical model breaks down for the, in the atomic regime. But this theory says that, no, actually that electron is radiating, but it's in a state of equilibrium as it absorbs energy from this zero-point field background. And so they ran these calculations and were able to find that they could replicate the discrete energy levels of a hydrogen atom this way. So that's really intriguing to me, that there's a classical possible model for electrodynamics of an atom.
Yeah, I guess it's not the classical model for electrodynamics. It's a classical model for the quantum mechanics of the atom, those energy levels. That's not the electrodynamics of the atom.
I mean, whenever you have a charge that's moving in a circle, it's going to radiate energy, right? That's a classical thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so they're just saying that it actually is doing that, and the energy is being replaced constantly by its coupling to the zero-point field.
Yeah.
So I love that. I think that's really exciting and beautiful.
That gets us to the basic principles of this linear stochastic electrodynamics, because that's the first one. So this linear stochastic electrodynamics works when a particle is in equilibrium. And how they define equilibrium is the energy radiated out from the particle balances the energy that it absorbs from that zero-point field. So that's the first thing that they're looking for. After that, so I call that the principle of equilibrium. After that, they have the principle of the field. That is, when the particle is in equilibrium, its motion is dominated by that zero-point field. It's dominated by those random fluctuations, and then you get something that looks like quantum mechanics. So if it's not in equilibrium, and if it has enough energy, it's not, then it does not look like a quantum mechanical particle.
Oh, so I see. So they're making the classical, the distinction between classical effects and quantum effects by how well it's coupling to the equilibrium state. Well, how much is in the equilibrium state to the zero-point field. I like that. That's a really intuitive way of looking at it.
Yeah, and then the third principle is fairly interesting. It's the principle of irrelevance is what I'm calling it here. So what it's saying is that it doesn't matter what the actual realization of the field is, as long as it has these basic properties of, you know, the energy density and stuff like that. So there could be so many different actual ways the zero-point field looks, right? There could be tens of billions of ways, or probably many, many more, probably, let's say, 10 of the 50 different ways that it could actually happen. And it doesn't matter which of those billions and billions and billions and, you know, many, many more than billions ways this field could be constructed, as long as that construction has that sort of same energy spectrum, it's still going to give you the exact same result. So one of the things that De La Pena and Seto claim is that you can't take the path of the particle, let's say you found the path of the particle, or you can't find the path of the particle from just looking at what it was happening here, where it ended up there, because there are many, many different stochastic fields that would do exactly the same thing. And so you can't reconstruct either the trajectory or the zero-point field, because there are so many different ways for it to actually happen.
So there's just a few simple parameters that this background zero-point field would have to meet. And so they broke those out and said, as long as it's any field that meets these criteria.
I think it's something like that. I think it's a little weaker than that, but I think that's a good way of looking at it. So I think that they don't have criteria. What they're going to say more or less is that you can look at these trajectories and figure out a general class of these zero-point fields that would have to happen. You can figure out something that has to do with the energy densities or something like that. But as far as I can tell from reading the paper, they haven't said to get stochastic electrodynamics to work, you have to be in this particular class. It's just saying that out of any particular class, you're going to get the same results.
It's interesting that we can't determine what the exact nature, we can't define the exact phenomenon of the field, but we can sort of figure out what criteria it needs to meet in order for the math to work in this theory.
I think that happens a lot. It's a lot easier to figure out the criteria for the math to work than to actually get it to work. Yeah, I think that's one of the issues with axiomatic reasoning, though, right? You're supposed to be able to figure out at least one place where the axioms actually work to show that they're consistent. So the proof of consistency is making basically a model that works. But that model doesn't have to be the model that you care about, but you have to be able to produce a model.
And that's what they've done here with the non-relativistic phenomena, right?
Oh, well, I don't think that's what they did here. I think this is a little more philosophical a paper. So I think probably when you get to that derivation paper that I was talking about, that derivation paper probably does quite a bit to getting there. I think this particular paper that we read is a little more philosophical in nature, and it's sort of trying to explain how stochastic electrodynamics actually explains things.
I think it's their book, The Quantum Dice, An Introduction to Stochastic Electrodynamics, that was that reference 8, and that's what you're referring to, right?
That was the book that they keep referring to over and over in this. But this derivation paper that came out last year, that looks like they've done quite a bit.
Oh, that's exciting.
So, I mean, when you start looking at this, they're talking about some of the problems that stochastic electrodynamics had had. And rather than being problems with these things that we just said, there were some problems with the math. And they were trying to do sort of perturbations that really didn't work because they weren't really valid perturbations. A perturbation is just assuming that some parameter is just a small deviation from something that's easy to solve from, someplace where it's sort of normal. And that apparently failed. And they were also talking about that had something to do with the Fokker-Planck equation.
That's what I was looking for, Fokker. That reminds me of the movie. So it was that Fokker-Planck equation, which wasn't applicable to this scenario. So they had to go back and recalculate it from first principles. Is that that's sort of what I got out of it?
Yeah, they went backwards out of that. So something that they were doing didn't work out. At the beginning, it sounds like it's the Fokker-Planck equation isn't working out. And I'm not sure if it's because the perturbation theory doesn't make the Fokker-Planck equation, or if they were starting out with the Fokker-Planck equation because that was the result of the usual perturbations and going from there. Now, the Fokker-Planck equation just relates the drift and the diffusion of a wave function with time, so it probably should be reasonably close to whatever you predict. It should usually be valid. And in fact, that's one of the things I was trying to get to here, is in that derivation paper, they used the equation of motion and the zero-point field to produce a stochastic Liouville equation, and that, when they smoothed that, they got a Fokker-Planck equation that was viable for stochastic electrodynamics, or at least they claim is viable for stochastic electrodynamics. That's a Fokker-Planck equation that has sort of an infinite memory.
Ah.
Okay. Mm. And after they get that, then they can get the Schrodinger equation, and they can get the Wigner distribution, and they can get a correspondence principle.
Well, that's really fascinating, because I'm remembering the papers that we looked at with pilot wave hydrodynamics, and how the Walker created the little droplet bouncing that they called a Walker, that each bounce created like a memory in the wave modes of the oil. So its total predictive movements were depending on this like seemingly infinite series of vanishing memories from previous impacts with the oil bath.
Yeah, and in that case, there had to be a low enough damping, I think, so that those things persisted for a certain amount of time. So for that physical realization of quantum mechanics, or I guess it's not a physical realization, but that physical model of quantum mechanics, the issue with most fluids will be the wave from the bouncing droplet will damp out and will lose their energy before the droplet comes back down and hits, and so it won't have that self-interaction that creates the quantum mechanical behavior.
So it's fascinating that both of those models have this quality of memory in this background. That's really intriguing to me. I wonder what the implications for physics is there.
I think it's not too much, because the memory here, I think, is probably going to be the same sort of memory. So now when you've got this particle moving in this field, what it's doing is anytime it turns, anytime the zero-point field gives it a bump, then it's going to turn. It's got this acceleration. It radiates out some photons. Those photons go into that zero-point field, and they're doing the same sort of things that the ripples in that wave are doing.
It's intriguing, because you're thinking that here's a scenario where the motion of this particle is being determined not only by this stochastic noise that, you know, this random fluctuations, but there's also proper like this interactions, an ongoing interaction with the past events. So those are still having an impact on your physics in a future time. So it's not enough to know what happened just with the last particle collision, for example, but you need to also know what happened before that, and before that, and before that, and then layer on a level of randomness on top of that. This could see where this gets really complicated.
Well, you can, but you might be a little interested in trying to figure out, do you really need the randomness at that point, too?
Right, right. How many of the randomness is from past events, right?
Now you have past events. You also have lots of other things running around doing the same thing.
And those are all interacting with your background to create the conditions for the next event.
That's right.
Wow. I love the idea of the universe having a memory like that. That's really fascinating.
It basically does. I mean, otherwise you wouldn't be able to do any sort of cosmology or astrophysics, right? So let's see. What interesting things do they do in this paper? I think the thing that they do next is they start to talk about how they actually model the movement of something moving around, model the movement of this particle.
Right, the trajectory issue.
Yeah, and the way they seem to do it is they say that the force, the mass times the acceleration, is equal to some force, and I'm not sure what this force is, they don't even define it, plus the two terms that we care about, which is the radiation reaction force and the stochastic field. And that's the Bradford-Marshall equation. And they neglect the spatial dependence of the stochastic field because apparently the wavelength over the time is much greater than the velocity of the particle. So the particle doesn't really notice the variation in the zero-point field. So those wavelengths are apparently fairly long. And that creates a Hamiltonian with pretty much the same sort of things. It has this radiation reaction term, which is, I think, the shot energy.
What is the shot energy? I don't know that offhand.
Well, I think that's the same as the radiation reaction force. Looking at it, it has the right sort of form so that when you take the derivatives, more or less, you end up with the radiation reaction force. Because the radiation reaction force is proportional to the jerk of the particle.
That's the third time derivative?
That's right. And the shot energy is related to the projection of the velocity on the acceleration. So I think those are actually the same term. And that's where they get this idea about the equilibrium. So when the Hamiltonian gets to a certain point, the radiation and the absorption term are in equilibrium and everything's happy for us. And that actually gives you commutator relations. And this in this paper, they derive the Heisenberg relation. Which relates the time rate of change of operators with the Hamiltonian.
Wait, they derive that from first principles?
It sounds to me like they get that from this equilibrium relationship of the Hamiltonian.
That's exciting.
I don't know exactly how they do it. I know that they got there from the uncertainty relationship, and I'm not sure if they started with the uncertainty commutator. I'm not sure if they started with the uncertainty relationship and then somehow got to the uncertainty relationship in terms of operators, or if they went a little bit farther. But to get to the uncertainty relationship in terms of operators, that they use the stochastic electrodynamics to do, and then the Heisenberg relation comes from that.
How does this apply to the atomic stability? I'm intrigued by that subject.
Yeah, there isn't very much left to talk about as far as the basics are concerned. For the atomic stability, and I think this goes with your energy eigenvalues and origin of quantization, you have certain places where you have a kind of resonance where the energy in is equal to the energy out. So basically, if you're in one of these orbitals and you get a little shot of energy that would push you away from that orbital, the damping from the radiation is going to pull you back in there. So unless you get a big enough shot of energy to push you into the next orbital.
Oh, I see.
You're always either going to be gaining or losing energy until you get back into that thing. So one of the things they keep on going on and on and on about, maybe not on and on and on, but at least on and on about in this paper, is that you're not usually in equilibrium in this theory. You're just in that equilibrium on average.
Right.
most of the time you're sort of in equilibrium. Sometimes you'll probably be a little bit off here or there. So you have these resonant states based on these interactions between the radiation and the fluctuations, and that's how you get the energy.
What I seem to be getting out of this is it seems like in this scenario, the time that it would take for an electron to decay from an excited state to the next lower bound state would be fairly random. And so are they saying that our experimental observations are statistical sums of observations so that it appears that they have a certain amount of time in each energy level under specific conditions, but they're actually very random? Is that what they're saying?
No, I don't think so. I think you end up with the same sort of idea, is that at some spots it's a lot harder to move from one energy level to another energy level. So it sounds to me like you do have these trajectories, you do have these energy levels, but it does not sound to me like, ouch, forgot what I was saying.
Well, I'm just trying to think in terms of if you were able to observe a single atom, the time its excited states, if you would see the really simple mathematical stabilities of each of those orbitals as sort of a fixed quantity, which is sort of the picture that I get from quantum mechanics, or if it would appear to be a very noisy jumping around of energy levels that would only statistically on average give you this really simple mathematical relationship.
I think it's probably noisy already. I think it probably is already noisy. As I recall, you can sort of get a half-life for something being in an excited state before it will eject an electron, right? Although they do have that quote here, nature is noisier than quantum theory asserts. So I don't remember who they say said that, but they are thinking that there is more randomness in the world than even quantum theory says.
Well, it would be fascinating if there was some kind of experimental way to test that and see which theory predicted the more accurate observations. Like, you know, if we could suspend a single hydrogen atom in some kind of field, maybe like an acoustic field or something like that, and observe exactly how noisy it was, maybe we could discern between which theory is more accurate.
In a way, you know, with sort of a standard interpretation of quantum mechanics, if you're doing that, you're basically observing the thing all the time, at which point it never does anything. And if you're looking at this, when you're doing that, you're always keeping it far enough out of equilibrium that it's not really going to obey the sort of things that you want it to do. So in either case, you're not going to get the thing you actually...
Ah, crap.
Okay, and like I said, I think that's more or less the same thing for the origin of quantization, is this reduced set of viable solutions because of the energy balance. And the energy balance is always trying to get you into one of these situations where the energy lost by your particle is equal to the energy gained. And if you go a little bit off, it's going to keep pushing you back into one of these solutions. So any place where you get that nice sweet spot is going to be attractive to the particle. It's going to try to get into those sweet spots.
Yeah, and I think they've got the functions here for how that works, because you've got certain levels of energy interaction for the radiation and the absorption, right?
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, here it's actually saying that trajectories are nice here. So they're using the trajectories to talk about this very thing, the transitions. So in quantum mechanics, these transitions between energy levels are a little bit magical.
Right.
You know, at one point you're in one energy level, and the next point you're in another energy level, and somehow the electron has to know which energy level to jump to before it decides to emit or absorb a photon, which I'm not sure if that's really true, but I think there are enough people that believe that it's worth looking at. Whereas here, your trajectory is just pushing you from one to the other. You know, at one point you get hit with a little bit of this vacuum fluctuation energy, and it pushes you over the attractor to one equilibrium, to the attractor to another equilibrium, so you're attracted to that higher energy level.
Yeah, I've even seen online people talk about how there's a zero transition time between one orbital and the next, and that never sat well with me.
I don't believe that's really true. The way I understand quantum mechanics, the transition time is, well, you get to this thing where you have delta E and delta T, right? So you can't know the transition time to within better than the energy difference between the levels.
Oh, I see. So that's totally different.
That's how I understand that. Now, I think a lot of times people will say, okay, you don't know which one of these times in here where that made that jump. That's another idea. So I think I've explained the way I think about these usually is that the wave functions for each one of these energy levels are probabilities for this electron to be at a particular spot with a particular energy or with a particular momentum. And so these wave functions are probabilities over all those X's and P's. And then, you know, at some point you have some sort of interaction with your electron, or you have an emission or, you know, an absorption of an electron. Well, that doesn't mean that at that point the X's and P's change. Well, it does mean the P's change, but the X's don't change. It just means that you get this collision with a photon, and that changes your momentum. And now you've got a different set of probabilities for where your thing's going to be. It could have just started at whatever that position X was where it already was, assuming it had a position, which somebody in the Copenhagen interpretation would deny.
That's what makes me sit back on my heels when I look at this theory, is that all of these postulates of quantum theory are being looked at here as statistical outcomes of a more fundamental way of looking at it that's absolutely causal and phenomenological.
Yep, I think there's something to that. You know, again, we were just talking about that instant transition. And if you're trying to say something like the Copenhagen interpretation, you can't really say any more than you can say, you know, my particle has a position, that it has a time. We're well aware that time and position are you know, the same idea. To a great extent. So they're very well coupled. So saying it has a time is no different. And then you're trying to say that at this interaction time, it's instantaneous. But how can it be instantaneous when you don't even know what this whole wave function collapse is, right? If you don't know how the wave function collapses, how do you have any idea about when or how long it takes an electron to absorb a particle? You don't have any idea about that, and it just doesn't work. You can't make those sorts of assertions as long as you're sitting around denying the very meaningfulness about talking about those sorts of things. If you can't talk about space, you can't talk about time, and if you can't talk about time, you can't talk about the duration of that transition any more than you can talk about an observation of the thing in any event at any time. It's just not logically compatible. It just doesn't work.
Do you like this way of looking at it? Do you find this to be more intuitively appealing?
Yeah, I like this. I'm not sure about the zero-point field, but I like the general idea is that you've got a bunch of interactions wandering around, and it gives you a reasonable idea about a lot of things that can work. You know, we've talked about all this stuff before, this sort of single particle versus ensemble idea. We can't really talk about a single particle too much in this idea, but we're not denying the particle, which is perfectly fine by me. You know, we live with statistical mechanics every day, right? I can't tell you where every atom in this room is, but I can sure tell you that it's warmer than it was yesterday. So, I mean, it's okay to work on that level. I mean, it's sort of the institutionalized ignorance that's a little bit vexing. Yeah, that whole role of the observer thing, I don't like that at all, ever. It doesn't matter whether or not I peek in the box. Mr. Cat is still just as dead. And, you know, that's going to be true when I, you know, walk into the lab on Monday morning. I'll notice right away without opening. I mean, this is all very, very interesting. I mean, they even have a rationale for uncertainty relationships, which is the size of the zero-point fluctuations, which are supposed to happen at something like H-bar. They're related to H-bar in some manner. I do like that it has real explanations for things, which is sort of the opposite of what seemed to be the most popular and the most accepted interpretations, the Copenhagen interpretation and, sadly, the Everett interpretation.
Isn't it frustrating that a theory this interesting and kind of intuitively appealing and classically powerful has so few people working on it that, I mean, you just almost never even hear about it?
I don't think it's too bad. These guys, these particular guys, De La Peña and Seti, are publishing fairly regularly. But I think if they were in America and not Mexico, they're not going to get the funding that they need to continue with their research.
That's heartrending because, you know, we've got all this money pouring into like superstring theory and so forth. And this one has a similar problem in that you can't pick which of those zero-point fields is the right one. But you can certainly qualify that it's within a certain class that has, you know, certain parameters, which is more than superstring theory can do.
You know, there are a couple of things here. Is one, when I talk about these classes of zero-point backgrounds, I think those classes, they keep talking about a particular realization. So each one of these things is statistically supposed to be the same. It's just when you actually look at it, something about the phases are just different and so forth and so on.
Right.
On top of that, one of the claims in this paper is that there's not necessarily only one. There's not necessarily only one zero-point field. There can be multiple zero-point fields, and this thing's perfectly happy. So that's good, too, because, there's no reason why there should be only one thing going on there, especially considering we have quantum mechanical particles that don't happen to be electrons.
Right.
If all we care about is this electromagnetic field, then we're pretty much stuck with the charged particles. But neutrinos still have to do their thing, right? I mean, you still have to worry about other quantum mechanical particles, so there should be other zero-point fields. That would also be a way, if this shows itself to be really, really strong, to sort of try to sneak gravity in there, is to try to look at the fluctuations in the metric. There were fluctuations in the gravitational metric similar to this, that could also give you some effects and sneak gravity in with quantum mechanics. I think this was actually their suggestion, not mine. I didn't make that up as much as I would have liked to.
Well, that's one of the really, really exciting areas that's constantly under work on this theory is explanations for inertia and gravity.
So I think those are all pretty nice. As far as this thing is concerned, let's see, was there anything else here? I think we should note that there are observed and unexplained quantum mechanical effects, right? So it's not as if...
It's not complete by any means.
And I'm not talking about this, I'm talking about quantum mechanics itself.
Oh, I see, right.
So there's an anomaly in the neutrino rest mass. Origin of 1 over F noise. 1 over F noise is pervasive, happens all over the place. What is that's origin? Electrical engineers would be happy with you if you could figure that out. You know, there's also this high energy tail of cosmic rays. And even you could think about the origin of the zero point field. I think a lot of people actually do believe in that. So there are plenty of things that even regular quantum mechanics can't explain. On top of that, I guess there's another one regular quantum mechanics does not explain at this point, which is this thing called spontaneous parametric upconversion that I guess this does.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating experiment. He's saying that if you shine like an infrared laser on a nonlinear crystal, that because of the zero point field, some of those photons get bumped up into the visible spectrum. So you can actually detect visible photons coming out of the crystal. That's really fascinating.
Now, spontaneous parametric downconversion is a way that they get entangled photons. So do these photons going in have to be entangled, or do they just have to be in phase? Do you know anything about that?
I don't remember the details of the paper. I do remember that he seemed to think that he had an explanation for entanglement that entailed the zero-point field, but I don't think he got into it in that paper.
Okay, well, I mean, there's plenty left to talk about. I think I had somewhere here that another fairly successful stochastic electrodynamic model was called SEDS.
Yes, they add the spin to it.
And I think that does a job on some of these other things we were just talking about.
Well, this has been a really interesting discussion, and I hope that our listeners have enjoyed it. I think there's a lot of work to be done on the theory still, but the indications so far are really exciting to see the successes they've pulled out of it with just, you know, a small sliver of the physics community taking a serious look at it. I wonder what the implications could be, you know.
I'm happy with it. Are you happy with it?
I love it.
Awesome, Randy. Well, thanks for talking with me tonight, and let's see if we can do this in another week or so.
Sounds great. Thanks for shedding some light on this fascinating subject, Jim. Good night.